KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up, a question of solar energy and whether it can solve our energy needs. PG&E just signed a contract with two solar companies to provide a huge amount of power to the grid, more than anywhere else in the country. Has solar's time come? And what kind of solar power is best? The kind you see on home roofs, huge fields of panels in the desert? Photovoltaic cells or thermal? We'll explain those key terms and bring you up to date on a crucial technology that some people are hyping as the solution to our energy needs. So stay tuned and you can join us after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. This hour, a look at solar power and whether it is the answer to our energy needs. Last week, Pacific Gas and Electric announced it would buy large amounts of power from two companies that intend to cover 12.5 square miles of central California with solar panels down by San Luis Obispo. On sunny days, those panels will generate 800 megawatts of power, which is about what a small nuclear plant or a large coal plant would produce. That's never been done on that scale before, so it's a big deal. But there are lots of questions to be asked. How will that power get to PG&E customers? Will transmission lines be bad for the environment? What role will photovoltaic cells on people's houses or on the roof of KQED, for that matter, play in the big picture? What about other forms of solar power, like thermal, whose promoters say it's more efficient than the technology PG&E is buying? So we'll talk about all of that this hour with my guests. Dan Kamen is professor of energy at the University of California at Berkeley and co-director of the Berkeley Institute of the Environment. J.P. Ross is vice president of strategic relationships of Sungevity, which is in Berkeley. He's formerly of Vote Solar and a member of the SF Solar Task Force. And Carol Libby is the project manager with Electric Power Research Institute, which is an industry group, a research arm down the peninsula. So welcome to all of you. And Dan Kamen, nice to talk to you again. Wonder what you make of these two big contracts that PG&E announced last week. Is it a big deal?
Oh, I think it is a big deal. There's a couple things going on. One is that if all of this comes to pass, and we'll come back and talk about the if, I hope, in a bit, this would actually bump Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, into a position where they would meet the state's renewable energy target, this 20% by 2010 or so, and then we're hopefully on a pace to get to 33% by 2020. And the reasons why it's a big deal are, one, you said in the beginning, that this is a big jump up in the amount we're talking about. 800 megawatts is a lot of power. It's also a lot from a number of different companies, which I think is critical. There's some photovoltaics in this mix. There's some solar thermal. There's a range of companies that get into the act.
I thought there were just two companies.
Well, there's a lot of players that will now be getting into the mix, seeing that we're hopefully opening the doors to start buying significant amounts of solar. And the other feature, which is really important in the story, is that this is very much contingent upon sane and sound action at the federal level, something where the presidential candidates differ and where we have seen a really spotty record in the past of passing the appropriate incentives for this part of the clean tech world. So it's really important that this happen. It's also important that there was coordination between what's happening at the state level and at the utility level with the federal. And it can also be a real push to get even more innovators and entrepreneurs into the clean energy field, not just solar, but also wind and other technologies as well, if they feel there really is a place at the table for them all.
Now, you mentioned incentives, and I assume that's a kind of a code word for tax incentives and tax credits. How does that play into this whole thing? Let's get that out of the way at the top.
Well, I'm not sure we can ever get it out of the way because it's so central. But you're right. There's two types of major credits out there right now. Solar primarily takes advantage of something called the investment tax credit because it's capital intensive up front. And wind and others take advantage of something called the production tax credit because it's less capital intensive up front.
So basically, though, just so we understand, a tax credit, if you build a solar plant and you spend a lot of money, what do you get credit from the federal government for profits you may eventually make?
You get credit for the amount that you invest, and then this hopefully and usually does translate into clean energy actually on the line. And but the big issue here has been that this is something which has been fought over and passed or not. In fact, it's been passed each year individually as a battle. And people overseas look at us and just scratch their heads because this is the sort of thing that's been very, very effective. It's cost effective. It gets energy on the grid. And it makes no sense to have to battle over it year by year. We really should be sending a 5 or 10 year blanket extension to lock these things in. And somehow we've been unable to do that despite all of the interest and talk about energy. And these deals for PG&E are contingent upon those credits passing.
Okay, now you mentioned that this is an annual thing, so you mentioned in passing, but that's one of the interesting things. Every year, Congress has to renew the tax credits for this industry. So that's sort of built-in crisis every year, I would assume.
It is. And in fact, when you look at the curves and the number of production of new deals and the number of issues that bring this up where different companies are trying to get the financing set, when it looks like it might not pass, those things drop off. And then right after it passes, then there's sort of a window of peace and people can get things going and they go up again. But it's really the worst possible investment climate to make this an uncertainty for the industry as opposed to really locking it in, and as something that we've been working on, a 10-year blanket extension, for example, so that this investment environment is always there. Unless that happens, these deals are going to be at the whim of these kinds of annual political battles, and it really dampens the investment spirit and the ability for the utilities and the state to plan on how much clean power we're going to get for both economic and environmental benefit.
Okay, now let's turn to J.P. Ross, who's the Vice President of Strategic Relationships with Sungevity in Berkeley. And Sungevity is a company that provides home solar electric systems. J.P., you've been active in Greenpeace in a prior life, and now you're working kind of in the industry. This whole question of tax credits, crucial to this, and the other thing I wanted to ask you is about how big a deal we are at right now. Is this a crossroads with these two contracts being publicized?
Thanks, Spencer. I would say that this is an incredibly big deal. And as Dan says, the extension of the investment tax credit, not just for a single year, but for 10 years, as the Solar Energy Industries Association and advocates across the country have been arguing for the last few years, myself included, while I was at Vote Solar, and now at Sungevity. The extension of the investment tax credit is absolutely critical to a national solar market. What we have right now in the United States are a few functioning state markets, California, Colorado, New Jersey to a certain extent, and other states across the country, where the states have really taken the lead. The federal government has chipped in with the investment tax credit at the commercial and residential level, but to date, the single-year extensions, as Dan says, really creates a stop-start environment.
Well, wait a minute. Let me just stop you there a minute. Why is it so crucial? Solar is the one part of green technology that seems to be blasting along very fast and doing very well. There are lots of people entering the field because they think they can make money, and a lot of companies are making money. So why do they need this tax credit at this point? And somebody, you know, with your background arguing for a business tax credit, I find that interesting.
Well, you know, the reality is that it is not a level playing field. If you're comparing renewable energy technologies like solar and wind and other green technologies to the existing infrastructure of nuclear, coal, natural gas, and oil, the reality is that there are tremendous tax credits that are granted to all of those technologies that are kind of wiped away in the argument that renewable energy should be able to stand on its own 2 feet. So if we wanted to eliminate all subsidies for the foreign military to go into other countries to secure global energy supplies, Price-Anderson for nuclear energy, I mean, the list goes on. So the reality is that in order to enable a transition to solar and renewable energy technologies, incentives are necessary. The beautiful thing about solar in particular and renewable energy is in its entirety is that the fuel costs are not going to rise as fossil fuel prices go up. So we know that within a certain amount of time, and hopefully it's within the next 5 years, we'll be at parity with the utility grid, and subsidies will no longer be necessary for technologies like solar.
It seems to me, naively, that if you build a big solar field and you put up all these reflectors out there and you're collecting all this energy, the initial capital costs are very high, but once they're up there, don't they drop tremendously? You don't have to buy any oil. You don't have to buy any gas. It's there.
Absolutely. And you know, the single solar plant that has produced the most kilowatt hours out of any is a plant that was built in the 1980s, the Luz plants, which have been operating for a very long time now consistently and with very low operating costs. So absolutely, once the capital cost is spent, the fuel costs and operating costs are minimal, and the power continues to be produced very sustainably. Now, to get to your point is in how large this deal is, I think it's a fantastically large deal. And one of the main reasons is it really shows that solar and solar photovoltaics are coming of age. We know that solar energy works on rooftops. We know that solar energy works in small utility scale settings in the 10 to 12 to 15 megawatt range that already exist in the United States and in Germany and other countries around the world. And this is really the first time that a major utility is signing a large-scale solar PV utility contract to the tune of 800 megawatts.
PV meaning photovoltaic.
And
photovoltaics work, in one sentence, by converting sunlight to electricity. How do they do that?
They collect photons and excite electrons, and those excited electrons go run through your light bulb and make it shine at night, to be very, very simple.
Now we all understand that. Okay. Let's turn for a minute to Kara Libby, who is a project manager with the Electric Power Research Institute, which is down the peninsula and is the research arm of the industry. What have you seen happening, Kara, that in this industry? Are we at is this a big milestone?
Good morning. And yes, this is a big milestone. Typically, the larger plants have been concentrating solar power technologies that use mirrors to focus sunlight onto a fluid, and that hot fluid drives an engine or a steam turbine generator.
That's called thermal solar.
Yes, exactly. And the largest photovoltaic plants to date have been in the 20 megawatt range, and most of those are in Spain and Germany. The largest one, as JP mentioned, is the 14 megawatt plant, Nellis Air Force Base. So seeing this trend towards larger and larger photovoltaic plants is interesting, and certainly this announcement by PG&E is a big deal.
14,000 at Nellis to 800,000 in San Luis Obispo County, that's enormous, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, what?
It's a big jump.
It's kind of a scary jump. What made it possible?
Well, it's certainly possible. We're doing some work at EPRI to address the integration of large-scale renewables, looking at ramp rates in particular. With the solar thermal plant...
You lost me there. Ramp rates? I'm sorry.
Well, with concentrating solar thermal technologies, you have a certain amount of thermal inertia with this hot fluid flowing through the pipes. So when a cloud passes over the system, you don't see sharp power output drops. Whereas in photovoltaic systems, you don't have that storage mechanism. So when a cloud passes over, you can see spikes in the power coming from the system.
Okay.
We think that is something that needs to be addressed for these larger scale PV plants.
Well, do you think it is being addressed? Is something, some development made these bigger plants possible?
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, that's interesting.
We're certainly seeing, particularly in places like Germany, that larger capacities of PV on systems seem to be doing okay, but nothing at this scale has been built and tested. And I think the effects on both the circuit and also the grid system as a whole need to be looked at. If other technologies like natural gas plants are needed to step in when the PV power isn't available, the effects on those other plants need to be investigated.
Yeah, it sounds as though, from what you're saying, that if the state becomes somewhat dependent on these photovoltaic cells in these large fields, and we get a couple of months of bad weather, we're not going to have any power.
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's one thing when you have distributed rooftop systems dispersed throughout the system. When you have it all located in one place, I think that's when a little more thought needs to go into integration.
Interesting. Well, Monique Hannes is with us. She's the spokesperson for the Solar Energy Industries Association, or SEIA, and she's in Washington, D.C. Monique Hannes, what about photovoltaic? Is there any backup for it, or can they store power?
Well, I guess first to address the first part of the question and what I was hearing earlier, the one thing about solar that's quite nice is when you capture solar energy, you're typically capturing it and using it at peak times, when you need it most. And there are companies working on storage, and there are systems to store solar thermal now. So some of the newer plant announcements have included solar thermal storage. For instance, the Solana plant, which is a 280-megawatt plant, which is slated for south of Phoenix. And solar thermal is a little more cost-effective to store. And an analogy would be it's more efficient to store a hot liquid in a thermos over 12 hours or several hours. Right now, the battery technology to store electricity is still more expensive.
Right.
It is possible, though, and there are many folks that use battery backups in their homes, and certainly people here on the National Mall saw it during the solar decathlon where everybody had battery storage and backup.
So let me just try to explain this in terms I can understand. If you use solar thermal, which is concentrating all this energy from the sun onto a vessel that is containing some kind of mysterious fluid, maybe it's sand, maybe it's oil, maybe it's water, whatever it is, that will hold the heat and provide the electricity. Whereas if you're using photovoltaic cells, you need sunlight or at least ultraviolet light to keep it going. And if you got bad weather, you got a problem. So
I also have to say is over time, in the course of several days over time, solar energy, can easily produce 20%, and I take this from my own personal example, and it could be even higher if I use my boss's house. When you have distributed generation, it's definitely possible because, again, it's producing energy when you need it most during these peak times. And it does produce energy even when clouds go over, even on, nasty days. It's just a lower amount.
Okay.
So it can still be a large contributor to our energy mix here in this country.
Dan Kamen at the University of California at Berkeley, what do you make out of this idea of difficulty of storage for photovoltaic power?
Well, right now, that's a real issue because we have been very slow at developing better storage systems, not just conventional batteries, but some of the more interesting, innovative things. There's ways to store energy in compressed air underground, to use big rotating disks called flywheels and big capacitors. There's a lot of things we could do, but we haven't developed them very far yet. My concern is not in the short term. I believe we will be able to fix this because right now solar isn't such a big amount that it demands this huge amount of storage because we can always turn on or turn up the amount of energy we're getting for gas in the short term. But this should give us a real wake up that we need to work on the research to develop better storage. In fact, there was a very, very innovative new research result coming out of MIT just 2 weeks ago that suggests a very energy-efficient way to essentially make hydrogen. There's a whole number of these coming along, but at the federal level, we're investing so little in research that we're not going to develop these solutions. So I don't see this as a short-term reason to delay, even though some people have claimed that's really an issue. Solar is still such a small percent that it's just not going to matter in the short term. And by the time all these plants are built, hopefully we will have actually caught up the storage technology with our generation technology.
So back to the question we were talking about a little earlier, which is the tax credit idea. If you're going to build a big plant, you certainly want to have tax credits. But what if you're going to do some research into how to store electricity from photovoltaic, and you don't have a plant and you're not really producing it, you're banking on the future? Do you get the tax credit anyway, or should you?
Well, so this is a great point, because there have been a number of sort of small steps in this direction, and there are some bigger proposals coming out of some of the presidential campaigns. And the idea here is that there's also a research tax credit that you could get as well. And many of people have already seen online and in the conferences that Senator McCain, part of his presidential campaign, has proposed a $300 million prize for a better battery that was specifically designed for vehicles, for a plug-in hybrid car. But the same sorts of efforts could be applied to what you need for stationary power, for these solar ones. And in fact, part of the thing that the Obama campaign has said is that while prizes are nice, we also need just to boost up the research portfolio so that we don't need to sort of hope and wait for prizes to fill the gap. So I think that we have a good understanding of what's needed. The issue is, will we follow through and really invest in the area so that this never becomes a problem?
You know,
argue there's other policy issues here. If I could.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Sure.
This is Monique Hannis.
Sure. I would just say that probably a bigger issue here is you have some nascent industries that are ready to really scale up and get the cost of these renewable energy sources down. Solar is one of them. Wind as well. And wind is actually a little bit ahead of us. And we have a lot of sort of factors poised, a lot of investment dollars, venture capital dollars, and a lot of large companies that are making investments in solar divisions and also wind. For example, GE, BP Solar, you've got companies like Dow Corning with their Hemlock Semiconductor area, recent announcements by Intel and IBM. So these are companies that have, management. They've got manufacturing skills that they're now shifting over to the solar, which I would focus on here. That's going to really bring the price down. And that's our biggest challenge, is getting the price down so that solar can be more ubiquitous on rooftops and on the central station plants.
Well, it sounds from what I've read that the price is coming down, and it wasn't particularly competitive until recently, and now it's more or less catching up with thermal power, and maybe it'll get. In any case, one of the other flies in the ointment, one would think, is that if we're going to have a lot of electric cars and plug-in hybrids, and they're all going to charge at night, that's the time when you're not producing much solar power. Is that a problem, Monique?
Well, that's where, some of our cousins like wind can help pick up the slack. Wind powers very well at night. And as we advance on these storage capacity. But again, solar just has this huge capacity now to, as we heard earlier, to on an immediate basis could really scale up and contribute to our energy mix.
Okay,
during the peak hours.
Okay, so I'm going to hold on just a minute, Dan. We got to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We're talking with Dan Kamen at UC Berkeley, Monique Hannis with the Solar Energy Industries Association, J.P. Ross Sungevity, and Kara Libby. So you're listening to Forum on KQED-FM, and we'll be back to talk about solar energy in just a couple of minutes. I'm Spencer Michaels. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels in for Michael Krasny. We're looking at solar power this hour, right after PG&E announced it would buy large amounts of power, 800 megawatts, in fact, from two companies that intend to cover 12.5 square miles in Central California with solar panels. And we've got it. Speaking of panels, we've got an all-star panel here. Don Kamen is professor of energy at UC Dan at UC Berkeley. And Monique Hannes is with the Solar Energy Industries Association. J.P. Ross is Vice President of Strategic Relationships with Sungevity in Berkeley. And Carol Libby is with the Electric Power Research Institute. And let me give you a phone number if you want to join this conversation, ask a question or two. The phone number toll-free is 866-733-6786. And our email is forum@kqed.org. Okay, so let's talk just a little bit in terms of people who might want to put solar on top of their house, this same technology that they're going to use in the Central Valley or down by the Central Coast. I think J.P. Ross had a question or a comment before we took our break. So why don't you try that, J.P.?
Well, sure. My one comment was on the hybrid car question. Just to quickly address that, although most cars are parked at night, the vast majority of cars are also parked during the day. And there are many, many companies now working on smart charging technologies that will allow cars to pull power from the grid when the power is available. That is to say, you'd be able to plug in your car and it would know when to charge. So the idea that there's going to be too much solar on the grid in the short term is simply not possible. And when the amount of solar that's coming into the grid does start to invert the load, that is to be more than there's demand for, technologies will certainly be available that will be able to pull that off and use it. And plug-in hybrid or all-electric vehicles would certainly be one mechanism there.
Okay, turn to the subject of homes that want to put solar on their roof, the same technology, more or less, that's going on down in San Luis Obispo County. Does it make sense? And as one of our callers or email writers said, how long does a photovoltaic cell last, and what company makes the best photovoltaic cell?
Well, it certainly makes sense, and again, it makes sense because public policy is enabling this technology. Excuse me. California has the largest solar market in the United States, and that's due to the California Solar Initiative, a 10-year, $3 billion incentive program to enable the market transformation of solar technologies. And many, many systems have gone in California. We're over 25,000 now. Many people have decided that solar is indeed a viable technology to secure their energy prices for 25 years into the future, which is the warranted life on most solar modules. The return on investment on a solar system tends to be between 7 and 15%. For some customers, even higher than that, because California's electricity rates go up as consumption goes up. So people who use a lot of power actually pay quite a lot for their last kilowatt hours of power, and solar systems, by their very nature, actually reduce the most expensive power first. Sungevity is a residential sales and marketing and installation company who has developed a pretty cutting-edge technology that allows us to remotely size solar systems for customers' roofs using satellite and aerial imagery.
So, that's so much for the commercial here.
There you go. So there's lots of companies that are installing solar systems in the state, and many, many people, again, have chosen to go solar with a wide variety of them.
Okay, interesting.
To answer your question, though, about the how long they last.
This is Monique Hannes at the Solar Energy Industries Association. Go ahead.
Sure. Typically, and we can't comment on specific products, but there are a lot of great products out there. But they last and are warranted for 25 years, and typically last longer than that.
Okay. Before I take calls, this morning's New York Times has a phenomenally interesting story about wind power, which isn't quite related, but maybe it is. And the implication of it all is that there's a lot of practically criminal activity going on in the wind powers business, people bribing public officials and so forth to get places to put the wind power. All of a sudden, the great environmental movement has this sort of black eye, if you can believe that this is in upper New York State, upstate New York. Any thoughts, Dan Kamen, about the industry in terms of solar power? Is it all on the up and up? Is there any parallel?
Well, it's a funny story. I'm from upstate New York, actually, right where this debate's going on. And this debate largely has to do with the wind industry, with rights of ways and some of the Native American areas there and some power lines that are quite controversial. So I think what you're hearing here is that, in a funny way, the renewable energy industry is coming of age. Greed and corruption, sadly, are part of our overall economy. And it would be weird to think that because the technology happens to be better for the planet, that the whole field is somehow immune to that. In fact, what we expect is that the same sorts of business practices that exist in the rest of the economy, and I won't even get into now all of the really criminal things that have happened in our oil and gas and nuclear and coal industries as a comparison, but what we're seeing is the same kind of jostling for resources that we see everywhere.
Are we seeing it, though, in solar? And now we know it's happening in wind, if you can believe the New York Times.
Well, I think that the New York Times article may be a bit overblown here, but we will certainly see these same sorts of deals as companies jostle for best positions. I have not yet seen any large-scale, egregious activities in solar, but I assume we're going to talk about in a bit the issue that this solar doesn't come at absolutely no price, because when you start talking about covering large areas of land, there are going to be groups that say, and some of them will be correct, that this solar farm impacts, you know, a desert species or something else. And so it's not a simple issue, and certainly the best pieces of land aren't just those that are the best solar. They're also the ones that are nearest the grid, because this country hasn't invested in upgrading the grid for many years and
wires,
has to.
In other words, wires. Connecting.
In fact, the wires are the superhighways. So, for example, Texas just went through a very important process where their Public Utilities Commission agreed to spend $5 billion of ratepayer money to build essentially a transmission superhighway to bring massive amounts of wind power from West Texas and eastern New Mexico, something that will be, in the end, very cost-effective, into markets. As soon as that happened, people started working very quickly, some legally and some less clearly legally, to get access to the best tracts of land where that wind superhighway and a solar superhighway is going to be built. So what we're seeing is a maturation of an industry where business practices are not always on the up and up, but usually they are.
Okay.
And I would have to add, to put it all in perspective.
This is Monique Hannis again. I was just going to call on you.
Sure. One story that, you know, there's a few stories out there that are sort of making green look a little brown. And I just have to say that a vast majority, the preponderance of the folks in the industry are really working with a mission in mind, and they're out to solve environmental problems, not create them. They're out to, you know, improve the economy and do things right. They're reputable companies, stock-traded companies that care deeply about their corporate reputation, and I really do see this as an anomaly. And in a sad way, it is an example of a maturing industry, but I do see it as a very small example that just got highlighted today.
Okay, and I like your phrase, green turning brown. Maybe it's not original. Anyway, let's take a call from John in San Rafael. Hi, John, you're on Forum.
Hi, my question was half answered. 8 or 6 years ago, I heard an argument against photovoltaics that it took more energy in than you would get out of them. And I guess if they're lasting 25 years, they are producing more energy. If you could tell me what the ratio is. And also, as they age, do they start to get stale and produce less and less power? As a 10-year-old photovoltaic produces as much energy as a, you know, brand new one, or even a 15 or 20-year-old? And I'll take my answer.
Okay, let's try Kara Libby with the Electric Power Research Institute on that one. Haven't heard from you in a while, Kara.
Yes, good morning. Actually, I'd like to ask any of the other panelists to address the take more energy in than out question. I believe that it's more like a 5-year time frame.
Yeah,
for
I'm happy to. This is J.P. Ross. The time is right now around 2 to 4 years, for depending on the technology. One of the reasons why there is so much energy that goes into solar is because the main silicon wafers are very energy intensive to create, but the industry by and large is making those wafers much, much thinner and therefore require much less silicon. And reports have shown that with new technologies coming out, it will be around 6 to 18 months, as far as energy invested in that is then the amount of time the solar panel needs to be producing power before it recovers all of the energy. There is a slight degradation. Market standard, industry standard is about 0.5% a year. But again, the panels are warrantied for 25 years. And just because a panel is producing 90% of its rated output, in 20 years means that it's still producing power.
But just because it's warrantied for 25 years, it hasn't been around 25 years. How does anybody know that?
The first solar cells were out in the 1950s. There's lots of examples of solar cells that have been operating for that long.
Okay. Anybody else want to chime in on that one?
I just concur. It's Monique from Washington,
yeah.
And I concur. There was a definitive study done recently by Brookhaven Labs where they analyzed they were actually analyzing different types of solar thin film and the traditional PV, and they had the same conclusion that you heard, that the embedded energy, if you will, to produce the solar panel is recouped in 1 to 2 years.
Okay, we've got a lot of emails here, but let's take another call here from Keith in San Rafael. Hi.
Oh, hi there.
Hi.
I'm really excited about this news about solar energy plant in Central California. I am a little concerned, though, what will be the impact of this on future for programs and benefits that affect homeowners and individuals who want to do their own solar? I'm really in favor of using some more tax dollars to support decentralized power production, and I'd rather not see the power company that uses fossil fuels simply switch over to one that uses solar.
I'm not quite sure. In other words, you don't think big companies should be as involved as the individual homeowner? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I want both involved. If the tax credits and things get all passed out to corporate and private individuals or companies that do this, will homeowners still be able to put up their own solar installations?
Dan Kamen?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting point. In fact, this is a point that JP raised before, that we have some states that are very much in the lead, and California is a place where there's really been a thoughtful balance. And so the caller's question in California is not likely to ever come up. There is a aggressive program in place in the state called, it's got a number of names, Million Solar Roofs, California Solar Initiative, that actually locks in the support for homeowners to put this on. It locks it in for 10 years. So there's not going to be a reduction in the residential program. In fact, our hope is that these programs get extended more aggressively even to small businesses. And there's a pair of bills, that one of which was approved that was signed by the governor 2 weeks ago, one of which is up for a General Assembly vote today in Sacramento, that would actually make a very innovative form of financing, a solar and energy efficiency financing district, something that anyone in the state could do, where essentially you would be able to put these things on your roof and upgrade the efficiency of your home at the same time, which is often a great combination. In fact, it's almost always a great combination. And do that with no upfront cost. And you would pay for it on a property tax, whether you're a homeowner, that's where it initially would go, or a business. So the leading states are taking a very thoughtful, mixed view. New Jersey also has a very nice program in place, both for utilities and for homeowners. We're seeing a few others. This is exactly the sort of thing, though, and the caller is right on, that we're going to need some federal coordination. And until we really lay out a clean energy agenda for the country, it's going to be a state-by-state or a regional patchwork. And so there really is some needed federal effort. But I think that the areas that are innovating are very much concerned about this in a good way, in the sense that they're looking for programs that both focus on big companies and utilities and also at their residential and business scale.
Well, the one element we haven't talked about too much is the utility's involvement in this when it buys power or gets power from people who have photovoltaic cells on their roof. And Don from San Ramon writes us in an email, the big problem with selling your excess photovoltaic power back to PG&E is that if you have a net excess, they zero it out at the end of 12 months. everybody's laughing.
Right.
Why are you guys laughing?
Well, there's
it's
many
just how
reasons.
The contracts have been structured.
What does that mean, by the way, they zero it out? I'm not even sure.
What the caller means is if a particular home is producing more energy than they use on a regular basis, so that in a 12-month period, whatever 12-month contracted period they have with their utility, they were to actually produce a net excess, they're not getting paid a retail rate or anything at that point. And they really should. If you're producing more power and you're contributing to the needs, it would make sense.
We did invite representatives from PG&E to be on this show, and they weren't available. So we tried.
Spencer, just one thing I'd like to add to that. This is J.P. Ross. It also really speaks to the need for a diversified approach. And we've been talking about different types of solar technologies, utility-scale photovoltaics and residential roof-mounted photovoltaics. And the reality is that in order to, to tackle climate change and to really achieve energy security and energy independence, all of those will need to be taken up much, much faster than they are being taken right now. So, I don't feel that it's a matter of, if PG&E invests in a 250 megawatt or 800 megawatt PV plant in the Central Valley, are they not going to be investing in roof-mounted solar photovoltaic systems? The reality is that we need all of them. The diversity that we have in California from a renewables perspective, and solar in particular, is really enabled by the policies that we have in place. So we have, one, a renewables portfolio standard, which requires that the utilities procure a certain amount of energy from renewables, and this large announcement is a result of that. And the other is the California Solar Initiative that Dan referred to, which is enabled by policies that allow customers to quickly, easily, and inexpensively hook up their system to the utility grid, and require that the utilities, including PG&E, give those customers a net metering contract, which allows them to put their excess power into the grid over the course of a day or a month.
And get paid for it.
And receive a credit at
right.
the retail rate.
Okay, one of our callers, Dennis in Sacramento, I think, has an example to give us on that one. Dennis, go ahead, you're on forum.
Yes, I breed horses, and we're looking at renewable energy sources for our barn because I am on an ag meter, and agricultural meters, ironically enough, means that I pay about double what everybody else pays per kilowatt hour for the electricity that I use. We looked at wind, which the local industry area people here we have to deal with for permitting would not allow a single wind turbine. We looked at solar, and the problem is that when we penciled it out, it was going to take 20 to 22 years for us to amortize the cost of solar water and solar power just to zero out what we use, not necessarily selling any energy to back to the utility. And in my opinion, and from people I've talked to and associate with, and until solar gets to the point to where it is affordable, to where you don't have to amortize it over 20 years in order to make it pay for itself, it's never going to take off as a viable utility unless you have somebody with deep pockets who just, can dump a lot of money into it.
Dennis, is maybe the problem that you pay a higher rate because of the power that you use than the average homeowner pays?
Possibly, but the thing is, okay, so it takes 10 years to amortize it. That's still a long time and a lot of out front, and, right out of your pocket money. I mean, it just seems to me, and this, you guys have touched on it a little bit to the point where we need to, spend more time and research and stuff in it. And I think these fat cats and these oil companies, this multi-billion dollar profits aren't to be able to fork over 20% of that into research and development, because this is an industry I certainly think is viable. And I certainly think it's needed, and $1 billion would help out a tremendous long way to try to figure out how to make these systems where cheaper and more affordable.
All right, Dennis, interesting point.
Spencer, I would
go ahead. This is Monique Hannes.
Yes, the caller makes a really good point, and there's two sort of emerging trends. The first trend is we have to acknowledge that yes, solar is more expensive for now, and the recent growth we've seen, this phenomenal growth in the last 2 to 3 years, has been a result of policies that we've and incentives that have been put in place on the state level, not only in California, but in 30-odd states across the country that are encouraging the use of renewable energy, and specifically solar. On the federal level, we also have some incentives in place. Unfortunately, they've been very short-lived. We've had them for 2 years. We got a one-year extension. They expire this year after 3 years. And 3 years just isn't enough time to really build up and scale up an industry that can, get the cost down. So the most experts in the industry expect that the price of solar will be on par car with traditional sources of fuel in about 8 years or so. And that's why the industry is asking for on a federal level to have these incentives in place to continue to stimulate this growth that we've seen and get that price down. There's another interesting trend, which is the financing side. And for commercial folks, and I believe that the ag sector would fit under this, you can work. This area has become a lot more sophisticated and active. You can work with a developer, and there are companies out there that will actually put the whole package together, and on day one, you're break-even from a cash flow standpoint. And the way that works is the incremental cost to finance this initial outlay, because the caller is right, that is the biggest issue with solar, is you're basically investing in your energy costs for the next 20 years all up front. But by financing that, the incremental cost to your mortgage or the financing vehicle is less than the monthly cost of your electricity bill. So on day one, you can be break even.
You know, since we're talking about all this, we're really talking about money here. It was represented to me that the solar industry is one of the few industries in the green field that is actually making some money. There's profits to be made. How much are those profits? Are some of these companies making a lot of money where that could be used as an argument that, hey, they're already making enough money, why keep giving them more and more incentives? They're getting rich as it is.
It's still a really, really small percentage of the energy sector when you look at it. But there are some stars, and it does show that, you know, we have a number of stock-traded companies, you know, on the NASDAQ, for example, and with growing capitalization that have models that seem to work. But what the industry is trying to get to is something like your caller said, where it could just be so much more ubiquitous, and it, you know, as easy as, you know, installing a new air conditioning system.
Right. In fact, some of our email writers have talked about how it ought to be ubiquitous. Let me take another caller here, because we've got a lot of them. It's a popular subject, obviously. Daniel in Los Gatos. Hi.
Hi. I was just calling just to get back to the original sort of PG&E conversation. I know these guys in Portugal just put in an 11-megawatt system. I think it took them 150 acres to do that. And the e-solar company that Google just actually invested about $10 million in says they can put out 33 megawatts on 160 acres. And so I'm wondering, you know, and I think it's cheaper to put in than the photovoltaic. So why has PG&E decided to go with photovoltaic? Is solar thermal just not proven yet, or it doesn't make sense to me?
All right, Will, you sound like you're underwater, but I think we understood you. Dan Kamen, what do you think?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting point, because there are some big differences. I mean, as we've sort of alluded to, solar photovoltaics, and actually I'd love to just, the caller, the agricultural caller, I'd love for him to call one of the local companies, because I do think that his numbers don't sound right anymore. Usually when your rates are that much higher, these things pay back much quicker. So my suspicion is that he's either gotten an older quote or something's funny in the math.
Well,
but
and he
this,
went
this
down,
really highlights,
if you remember, though, he went down from 25 or 30 years, whatever it was, to 10 years pretty fast.
Well, that's right. But I suspect, and we even had it sort of alluded to, it's even lower still. But this highlights the question that just came up, and that is that right now, the solar thermal systems, these power towers and the focusing dishes, are roughly half the cost or so of photovoltaics. But there's a number of other considerations, one of which is that you can install some of the solar much closer to demand centers. You can put it on rooftops of big box stores, on homes, on areas that are easier to get to.
Voltaics.
Where if you also include the cost of grid extension, which, again, we need another effort, both state and federal on, you can make it, I mean, you can make it quite a bit cheaper. And the other feature is that this push for solar photovoltaics is partially in response to something which was sort of anticipated, and that is there's a great excitement about solar thermal. And there are some very important new companies, BrightSource among others, who are coming up to do this.
Osra.
But right now, they are still ramping up their production capacity. And getting them to be able to build at this as much as we want to do it, as quickly as we want, is going to take some time. They've just got to build up the manufacturing base. Whereas solar photovoltaics, while still more expensive, is a more mature industry in terms of its commercial deployment today.
Okay.
So you really benefit by getting that mix of both of these online. And because, I think JP said it early on, one technology is not going to solve this. We really need to find programs that support them all. That's really why you want to get that solar PV involved, as well as thinking about the solar thermal when it's ready and when the grid lines go out to the places where it is really a prime resource.
All right. There's an email here from David in Palo Alto who says, is it not true that if we had more efficient transmission grid, we could store energy in forms other than batteries? For example, as is done in Michigan, pumping water into a holding reservoir to be used for subsequent electricity generation. J.P. Ross, does that make any sense to you?
Well, more efficient transmission lines would certainly be helpful, but that's not the limiting factor as far as storage technologies and capabilities. There's plenty. What you referred to in Michigan is called pumped hydro. That's using pumps to pump water uphill for use in a hydro facility later on. There's plenty of that going on in California as well. So it's not really a problem with more efficient transmission lines. Just one thing to add to the previous caller or to the previous question on solar thermal. We cannot. Make this point enough, but a long-term extension of the federal tax credit is incredibly important for all solar technologies, and especially the solar thermal electric that we're referring to.
You know, all of you folks are in favor of this solar tax credit, obviously. Is there anybody who's against it?
Evidently, it's failed in several Senate votes. It has received quite a bit of opposition.
Amazingly, this is Monique from Washington, and you know, I can say when we go and talk to the members on the Hill, we have support on both sides of the aisle. Everybody loves solar. In fact, everybody loves to visit plants and get their pictures taken, and now the presidential candidates love having all of this in their ads. The issue that's been holding things up in Washington is how to structure the bill.
All right, and on that note, I'm afraid we're going to end. Watch the presidential campaign, and you'll see more on solar. Thanks very much to Dan Kamen at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, Monique Hannis at Solar Energy Industries Association, J.P. Ross at Sungevity in Berkeley, and Kara Libby at the Electric Power Research Institute. This is Spencer Michaels, and this is KQED-FM. Thanks very much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.